am George Knapp, listening to That UFO Podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My guest today is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, writer, and director whose work often explores social and human rights issues through personal stories and investigative storytelling. Rising to prominence for myself and many of you listening and watching this show through the viral sensation, The Telepathy Tapes, that last year was one of the most downloaded podcasts in the world, knocking the King Joe Rogan off his top spot for a couple of weeks. And that is no mean feat, I can assure you. Welcome back to the podcast, Kai Dickens. Kai, welcome back.
Thanks, Andy. Good to be here.
It's good you can still mingle with us commoners after having the number one podcast in the world for a while. Incredible. And people probably don't understand how difficult it is to get into a podcast chart, stay in a podcast chart, let alone get to the point of knocking Joe Rogan off his top spot. I'm still a ways off of that, Kai, but that's been... That's been almost a year since we spoke. I just mentioned to you before I hit record, it was the 3rd of January. How has this year been for you coming off the back of the success of the first season of The Telepathy Tapes?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a complete whirlwind and I don't think I've completely digested it yet because it felt like what I thought, I was like building a wagon in my garage and it became like a rocket ship, you know, and then it was like, oh my gosh, like we have to build this rocket ship as it's blasting off. And so, you know, we've been like, hanging on for dear life, like hiring more people. You know, I never thought I'd make another podcast or we'd keep going with the talk tracks to unpack each season. But now, you know, we did have the talk tracks, which unpacks The Telepathy Tapes with a lot of really, I think, you know, interesting stories and some more in-depth investigation. And now we're doing a season two, which is going to be released, you know, I think when you air this today, October 15th. And, you know, then obviously finishing up the documentary. So it's been a really exciting year. So much progress, so much momentum for these issues that have, you know, as you know, you've been on the front lines, often like been in the shadows. So it's just an exciting time to be on this planet and be a part of it all.
Have you had time to breathe? Because speaking to myself back in January, there was still so much happening. Yeah. There was still content coming out. You mentioned the talk tapes. You talked mm-hmm. at that time about the documentary, I think was going to be getting made. It's now underway. Yeah. The second season's about to come out. Has it just been a continuation nonstop?
Yeah, it has been. And, you know, I obviously like take time. Like I try to make sure I read my kids to bed every night and walk them to school in the morning and, you know, but it is pretty much like working really long days right now and working weekends and a lot of travel. But I know for a fact, I mean, it's such a blessing and a gift when people care about something you've made. and it's not like I don't want to make the most I can out of this moment, you know? So I want to make sure to like, okay, if people are listening, I want to make a season two that is worthy of their ears and their minds and their hearts. And if people are writing in with questions or answers to keep unpacking it via the talk tracks and, you know, with all like the, you know, questions that people have had around like spelling or telepathy, making the movie is important so people can see for their own eyes, like really done rigorous tests that are double blind and in different rooms to validate all that stuff. So there felt like no ball that could be dropped without me regretting it for the rest of my life. So this is a moment in time. And I, every day when I fall asleep, I try to list in my head what I'm grateful for because that keeps it all in perspective. There's so much to be grateful for. So breathing is, you know, taking the time to really kick back and relax will happen. It will happen. But right now, this is just the season and I'm happy for the season, you know.
Well, if someone's picking this up now in October or even in the future, mm-hmm. you know, these mm-hmm. things, once they're there forever, aren't they? What is The Telepathy Tapes? If someone never caught it first time round, if someone looked at it and thought, oh, that's not for me, you know, most folks listening to this are listening for the UFO content, but quite often I'll branch out into remote viewing, ESP. Right. I've just hosted Dr. Ia Whiteley on the podcast recently as well, who's a space and aviation psychologist. There's a lot of crossover, I think, in that conversation within there as well. So what is The Telepathy Tapes all about?
Yeah. And I guess even like starting with that, like I think for a lot of listeners who are interested in the UAP and UFO world, you know, for many people, it's like that's a secret that's been hidden in plain sight that many people have been talking about for years, be it scientists, be it experiencers. And only recently have those people been kind of given the credit for the truth in which they've lived or experienced, you know, even though it's a mystery, even though we don't understand what it is or how it works, or if, is it consciousness playing with us in some way? Is it, we don't know. But in a similar way, for decades, you know, parents, teachers, paraprofessionals, therapists, principals, siblings, rabbis, ministers, all over the world have been experiencing, and scientists, and noting this phenomenon of non-speaking individuals seemingly being able to not just read minds, but have other gifts, you know, and many will talk about seeing, you know, beings that other people can't see, often the deceased, I mean, just all sorts of things. And so when I first started walking into this world, I didn't know what this was going to be. I had no idea if it was real. I didn't know anything. You know, what I first started talking to was a scientist, Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, who'd been, who'd heard about this through families and also found out that it was kind of spread throughout the world. And she did some experiments, and the experiments were very, 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 very compelling. And she had been trying to come, you know, she wrote a book on it. She had her license ripped away when she wrote the book. She got her license back, of course, you know, but like, but it wasn't an easy road for her. And so I didn't know if this was going to be a story about like us misinterpreting what's really happening for a scientist, or if it was, you know, these families who were, you know, just hopeful that their kids had some purpose. I didn't know what it was going to be. But then as I started meeting many, many families and teachers, and again, like I said, like the therapists and paraprofessionals and all sorts of people, it became very clear that this was kind of a secret hidden in plain sight for decades. And that, and it's, you know, there's been so much confusion around it because the people that are experiencing it, it's not even really about autism as much as it is non-speaking apraxia, which is this mind-body disconnect. Individuals who don't know they have a body sometimes, don't feel their body, don't know where their arm is, don't know where the hand is, and have a very hard time with fine motor skills. And pointing to letters to spell is a gross motor skill. And when spelling really popularized, so many parents had their experiences confirmed because their children, one, knew things that they'd never been taught, or knew things that were only in their minds, or they were able to test this and were able to get down to the nitty-gritty truth of what has been happening. So the telepathy tapes looks at these accounts of many parents around the country and world, and it peels back lots of layers beyond telepathy to the fact that many of these non-speaking individuals say that they can communicate in a quote-unquote telepathic chat room called The Hill. And that they are able to often have a deep, deep keen ability for precognition, knowing what's going to happen, for communicating with people who have departed. And there's a lot of mysteries to explore. And at the end of the day, I think the number one message, now that folks were starting to listen to non-speakers, was one of love and unity, that we're all connected. And we need to really start honoring that truth. So I hope that's a good nutshell summary.
It is. And can you just clear up one more thing? Because what I don't want to do is go into too much background on the first season. We've done that interview, and I would encourage folks to go and listen to the first season if you haven't, or at least go back and listen to myself and Kai speaking about it. That, I'm sure, will prompt you to go and listen to season one. But spellers, can you just quickly clarify to folks what are spellers when you mention that? Because no doubt it's going to come up.
Yeah. Okay, so the people that we focused on in the telepathy tape season one were non-speakers with apraxia. Doing sign language or writing with a pen, or language, speaking with, you know, your mouth, are all fine motor skills. It takes a ton of muscle coordination to do that, and fine motor ability. If you have apraxia, that's not something you can easily do. And so someone along the way learned that you could point to letters, and that's a gross motor skill. You know, that started with facilitated communication, which was really for people with cerebral palsy that required like a push so people could understand where their body was. Facilitated communication really got a bad rap because there were some scandals around consent and sexual abuse, and the whole thing kind of got damned due to some bad practitioners. Since then, it has been evolved into other forms like spelling to communicate or the rapid prompting method or spelling for communication for all these methods that require no touch. And often once people learn to spell on these big letter boards, they go to smaller and smaller ones and often start typing on their own independently into a QWERTY keyboard, you know, like a regular keyboard or an iPad. So that's kind of the history of spelling, and it has been, you know, deeply stigmatized. But I think that's changing. There's been a lot of, thankfully, a lot of great new interest in spelling to validate that, you know, authorship is coming from the individual kids. And I'm just so happy for all that research to come out. It's really going to validate these families and the communication method that their children are using.
After we spoke last time, I had a few listeners get in touch who have children who are either nonverbal or various different conditions or life-limiting conditions. Some of them had passed on. And it's such a difficult subject, I'm sure, to approach, because one, you're dealing with children and families that have very difficult circumstances in many cases. I've mentioned a few times on the podcast when it's been relevant, a family friend of ours lost her daughter quite young who was nonverbal. And forgive me, I don't know the full condition, but she wasn't able to have any quality of life that she could have done anything for herself at any time. So was under kind of 24/7 care. And she passed away as a young teenager. And it must be difficult for parents with nonverbal children, because they have a want and a craving to have something as simple as a conversation with their child, like me and you're having now, or we can have with our kids on a daily basis, that we probably take for granted because it's just a given. But they then have this thing they can cling on to that a lot of professionals in various fields will argue that's not real, that's pseudoscience, it's nonsense. And how do you navigate that you're not leaning to one side too much or the other, and you're trying to do this in a non-biased way, but of course through what you see in season one, for me personally, there is so much to this that points to this there being a truly genuine, I don't even know if phenomenon is the real word to use, because it just seems like something perhaps it's more natural than we realize.
Well, I think too, right, like I think a lot of the you know, skeptics around spelling have never ever worked with a speller or, you know, met teachers or practitioners who are using the method. And I think it just takes going and sitting with an individual to realize, oh, yes, they're pointing very quickly to letters. They are, you know, writing thoughts that the parents don't know about, or, you know, something that the parent disagrees with. So I think that if you just immerse yourself in the world of spelling to communicate as a practice, it quickly, you know, any skepticism around it falls away. And I think too, you know, one thing that people have to remember is that this isn't new. There was controversy around sign language. It took over 100 years to at least be brought into the American schools. It was, you know, people who were deaf were told they had to read lips and try to practice communication, you know, through voice. Well into the 1970s, and sign language was first kind of introduced, you know, over 100 years before that. And people thought that people who were deaf weren't smart. And the same happened with the blind. You know, when Louis Braille first invented Braille, people thought it sounded bonkers. Oh, you can read with your finger? That sounds impossible. You can write by typing dots and someone can read it with their finger. And so at the school for the blind where Braille was going, they took down his Braille. They hid the books and they wouldn't let them do the Braille because they thought it was fake. And the kids had to go into a room and try to prove this for scientists and journalists and all these people. And when they were doing one would spell and one would write, they'd say they faked it. They practiced this before. They knew what it was going to be. And it's just the same stuff they're going through now, right? Now, so this is not this is not new for a group of people who are missing a sense, be it sight, be it speech, be it hearing, to be told you're not smart, you're not in there, you can't possibly communicate. They find a way to communicate. We don't accept it. We don't believe it. And then eventually it becomes self-evident. This is not new. And it, you know, it's fun too, like in the film in particular, like we watch a speller learning to spell. And you see that the second he's looking toward the letter, he says it out loud. A, and then he hits it B, you know, or families, when I've been around them, where the parents just want a quick answer, like, okay, beach or biking, which one? And we got to go. We got to go. We have 5 minutes to get out of the house before the blood, you know, and then all of a sudden their daughter's like, well, it is a beautiful day today. So I'm thinking that first, and now beach or biking, which one is it? So, and then as we talk about in season two, which comes out October 15th of this year, is like one of the, we have an episode on plant communication, and this young girl was a non-speaker. And one of the first things she started communicating was medicinal cures of plants. And she says she can hear them via telepathy, that the plants can communicate, or I don't know what's exactly happening, but she was properly identifying people's ailments and then offering herbal cures through like random Chinese herbs, like astragalus or something that no one in the family knew about. And so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take much like effort to like immerse yourself with a speller, or, you know, or someone practicing this and then seeing, yeah, this is completely authentic. And, you know, we've looked obviously when making the podcast, like I remember well before it came out, like halfway through meeting these families, starting to like do a deep dive into the spelling, realizing like, if this isn't real, if this spelling isn't real, I can't put this out here because then the whole thing falls apart. Right. And, one of the most interesting things was, you know, this argument, oh, it's idiomotor, you know, people are cueing each letter. But to cue each letter, you'd have to scan to A. Is it, do I get a cue? Scan to B, do I get a cue? Scan to C, do I get a cue? Scan to D, do I get a cue? That takes a really long time. It took an immense amount of time to spell one letter. And, you know, when you're with a speller who's been spelling for a while, boom, 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 you know, the word comes out so fast, and those in the room can't even keep up. You know, it's often like the teacher who's working with them, or the coach or the parent, is quickly, fervently writing on paper all the letters. And I've been in so many situations like this. And then when you look down, it's just letter, 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 no spaces. It's just what? And then you have to do the work yourself of like, okay, where do the spaces go? What did they just write out? And so not knowing where they're going at the time, what they're saying, and then you put the spaces in, you're like, oh my God, the sentence is absolutely astounding. And that's a common experience. So, you know, it's easy, I think, for people to be scared of something or to harp on something that they don't understand. And I think in this case, it's this deep-seated, I don't know if it's ignorance. It's just, like maybe it is that these individuals who seem to not be in there, seem to not be able to control their body, seem to not be able to speak, could possibly be communicating. I think that's the deeper issue, you know?
Yeah, and I think people listening to this or watching this are used to it with the UFO topic, remote viewing, paranormal, if they're into ghosts, Bigfoot, all that kind of stuff. There's always an element of ridicule, ignorance, lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, stigmatism attached to all of these different subjects. And for folks who are maybe unsure of cueing, I think for me, when that was one of the criticisms for some of the folks back in the first season, would be that a parent sitting beside their child, and you're getting at the idea that if I'm the parent, as they're going about the board, I'm either using low level hums or I'm prodding them, or there's some kind of, I'm giving them, as you say, a cue that that's the letter I want you to hit, and almost like they are putting it on the child to pick that or force that. And I wonder, how have you then, and I'm coming into this, folks, not knowing anything about season two. I've not had any previews yet. Shame on Kai for that. I'm sure it's under lock and key, but how have you approached it then in this second season? Because I'm sure you must have thought, okay, there are certain things that you don't owe people, the public, anything. And one thing I'll clear up, I saw your interview with Ross Coulthart on News Nation, and you said that season one, you weren't going out there to set up scientific experiments. That wasn't your plan. That was very much in the moment, in the room. It was for you to view and report back on. Has that changed going into season two?
Well, it's, yeah, for sure. But more than anything, it's changed for the film experiments, right? So like season one was my effort to bring this quote-unquote secret that's been hiding in plain sight to the world, right? And to bring so many voices who've been experiencing this. And before spelling even started, mind you, right? So much of it was like, I'm wanting nuts and the child appears with nuts, or gosh, I just read the most horrible news on my phone in a different room and my child burst into tears. And, you know, so many of these things were happening with parents all the time. They'd hide Halloween candy, and the second they thought of where it was, their kid would, you know, run toward it. So these were kind of universal Or I need to put this videotape away. I need to hide it. And because I don't want my kid watching it, and all of a sudden the kid takes the videotape and hides it in their room. Like, there's so many stories I've heard from parents. So spelling made these things clear what was going on, but it's like not to let the thief was there way beforehand. And so season one was my effort to bring that stuff into the world. Season for the film, when it was like, okay, we really need to now do what we'd always been planning to do, which was hopefully film scientists doing this work, doing these experiments. Then it's not on me. I'm just filming the scientists. You know, I shouldn't be the one doing the experiments because I'm not a scientist. So what's been great is since the first season came out, University of Arizona, University of Virginia, Stanford, a Northwestern scientist, so many other scientists have now looked into this. They've done their own studies. The stuff is going to get published. It's all extraordinarily validating. A team of scientists at University of Virginia even looked through all of my original tests to look at like eyeline and contact and cueing and noise and all that stuff. And they've now presented their findings at a few conferences around the world, which is again, very validating. These kids were doing it. However, what's cool is in the film, you know, one of the things that came up is like, okay, can the spellers do this without someone sitting next to them? Well, that's like, you can't take away someone's, you know, communication support. That's how they communicate. So there was a scientist, Dr. Julia Mossbridge. Like, there were so many scientists writing in saying, I want to do this. I want to do this. And she was like one of the few that's like, why would we take away their spelling support when we can just put the person sending the cue in a way different room so that no one in the other room knows what the cue is? If no one knows, then it doesn't matter if there's a partner there. Mm. And so she worked with someone who had been on our season one, saw the telepathy tests, watched how quickly the kids get the answers. And he was a neuroscientist that does QEG neurofeedback. He had created this triple blind computers thing where like someone, a scientist or the study leader could hit a button and they don't know what's being sent, but on another computer, it could be in a different state, a different room, a video or picture pops up and that person has to look at this video or picture and start sending it to the receiver. And the receiver is in a different room or a different state. So it's kind of, I guess you could call that triple blind, if you will, right? Like the person doesn't know that's sending it. Only the sender has the video. The receiver doesn't know. The receiving, the non-speaker's partner, communication partner doesn't know. And so she started doing some of these tests across states. And we have one of the videos in the film where the person sending is in Oregon. The young man who's non-speaking, who's receiving it, is in Chicago with his spelling coach. And he describes the video perfectly. He describes the word on the screen. I mean, what is the chance of getting, I mean, it's like quadrillions to one. I can't even imagine the odds of getting that right. So they were able to validate this, you know, across states. And then they did it across rooms and the non-speakers rose to the occasion, you know? And so that was really exciting. And I know Dr. Powell's been doing a ton of really cool research and that's been bearing out. And, you know, we filmed a conversation that was really interesting with Dr. Powell and Dr. Mossbridge kind of talking about their research, which is going to be in the film. And one of the things I think they are both realizing is there's two types of telepathy. The question is no longer what it does telepathy exist? Are these kids capable of it? That's, I think, been settled with the science in the past year. I think the question now is what types of telepathy are there and how many? And there seems to be this very, very easy telepathy where when you're nearby someone, where it's almost like it feels like the non-speaking individual can like dip into the consciousness of someone near them and be able to, I don't know how they're doing it, if they're just reading their thoughts, looking through their eyes. I don't know what it is, but they can do that quite easily. But then there also seems to be this much more distant telepathy that can go from very far, you know, like distance is no barrier really to this form of telepathy. And that type of telepathy is almost more impromptu and urgent, often it's emotionally based, right? Something emergency happened, something is desperately needed to be conveyed. And that's really hard to capture in a lab. And we were lucky enough to capture that on film in a lab happening when filming the test. And then, of course, like just for fun, when we were with non-speakers shooting The Hill or doing, in other setups while filming, even if I didn't have a scientist there, sometimes non-speakers would be like, I want to show you, I can do it too. Okay. So then at that point we were like, okay, we're gonna put the blindfold on. We're gonna put the partition up. We're gonna, you know, do all the things, make sure there's no possible way there could be queuing, put earplugs in. And you know, the results were the same. Excellent, excellent. Almost 97% to 99% to 100% correct. And then we did a few fun experiments, which we need to put on our test library. We just have to get an editor to like take all of our hardcore big file footage and do it. Again, while we were at the Hill shoot, where we're like, let's just try to take spelling out of the equation. And we put one young man behind a partition, his mom on this side of the partition, and we'd show the mom like a flashcard. And then we'd put like 20 flashcards and, you know, 12, whatever, just different amounts of flashcards in front of him. And then like instantly the second the right one was down, he would hit it. So yeah, I think what's great about this and what's awesome for the scientists and the experimenters is it's not hard. It's not like going out and looking for, you know, a purple unicorn. It's like you walk into a room, if you've earned the trust and of the non-speaking individual and, you know, they're with a good communication partner, be it a teacher, a parent, a sibling, whoever. And if they say they have this gift of telepathy, that's easy for them to show it anytime on repeat as many times as you want. And we did a science roundtable as part of the film where we had people from Yale, UC San Diego, Northwestern, different neuroscientists, all sorts of people there and non-speakers at the table. And we showed them telepathy at the table. And it was interesting because I think there was this question of like, will they do it under pressure with all these scientists and all these cameras? And we had four cameras and a crew and, you know, a team of scientists and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bing, 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 bing. You know, and the scientist was like often like drawing the picture under the table. Like there's no way anyone could see it. I couldn't even see it. I'm filming it until the end. It was like, what was it? And the speller on the other side of the table, as fast as could go, you know, spelled out what it was. Not being touched. There was no letter door being held. It was on an iPad. And I think that those moments have made these scientists, their eyes pop out of their heads. And it's like, okay, this is very real. So it's been an exciting year. I think more than anything, just vindicating for the families. Sorry, was that a really long answer?
It was. I'm glad it all recorded. Yeah. I was going to mention about 6 minutes ago, but it was a good answer. Don't get that confused. About 6 minutes ago, there was a little bit of thumping in the background. Kai's got some work going on. It wasn't like a low-key game of Jumanji kicking off. So there was like a kind of dum, dum, dum. Yeah. In case that triggered anyone. But really interesting when you mentioned showing these scientists, folks in the mainstream, let's just say academics, and the light bulbs are going off. They're seeing this for themselves. Do you feel there's still a barrier to be broken down, though, for that to go to be truly accepted in the mainstream? Because it seems like at the end of season two, I imagine a lot of folks like there were at the end of season one were like, wow, this is real, this is true, this is genuine, this is a real thing. Mm-hmm. It still isn't accepted widely in the mainstream that, yep, telepathy is real. Mm-hmm. How do you get to that point? Is it the fact that you can't convince everyone because some folks just don't want to see or don't want to know that this is happening?
I mean, it's just, I think it's different. I probably have a very different perspective of this, right? Because I realize that I'm on seeing with my eyes, like all, you know, all that's kind of happening around us. So like we are getting scores of emails in every day, and usually it's people saying my world has completely shifted. I do believe in this stuff now and I didn't before. So I do think there's growing huge amounts of people growing in their belief of these things, which is great, you know, but again, that wasn't our mission. Our mission was just to, like, vindicate what these parents have been saying for years to try to get their, and also try to get their kids on, you know, educated. But I also think that as far as what the scientists are doing out there, I think the science will be out there, and, you know, I don't know how long it takes to get this stuff published, maybe another year, 10 months, 3 years max. So between the belief of hearing all these families, seeing how real and verified and widespread this is, right? These aren't like hundreds of people making something up in a grand scheme to fake out the world, nor is it a grand scheme to like fake people out that their kids are actually communicating when parents have tried so many things that don't work. They're always walking away from what doesn't work and don't want to hope. So I think that belief in it's real if you've listened is one thing, but then I think for those people still on the fence, the science is going to back it up and the experiments will back it up. And then sure, not everyone will believe, not everyone believes the earth is round, you know? Half Americans didn't believe Trump won an election and half do. Like, there's always going to be things that people do or don't believe in, based on your own worldview, based on the facts that you're consuming, based on what you want to be true or not want to be true. And that's okay. You know, I mean, what keeps me able to sleep and go forward is that I think, and probably for you too, I mean, I don't know, but at least for me, it's like, I couldn't do this if it wasn't true. I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't look at my children. I couldn't hire a staff and have them come around with me. I couldn't hire film crews and have them watch if it was all fake and lies. That's not how I can operate. And I think most people who are on the front grounds of like UAP work or UFO work or, you know, really interesting work that might be breaking down barriers, most people aren't being motivated to do something that risky and scary and controversial if it's false. What would be the motivation? You know?
No, that's very fair. And when I was watching the listening to the first season, and I watched the extra content on the website, folks, and we'll get to the second season having a visual element attached to it, of course, and the documentary that's being made as well, which I'll get you to clear up in just a moment, the details around what's happening there. But my favorite thing from the whole first season has been this element of the Hill. The Hill is this place where these nonverbal children and young teenagers, young adults can go to basically communicate the way I think people describe it in different ways, but a bit of a psychic chat room where they can go to, and they're maybe not confined by the bounds that they have physically day to day. And that must be, I think for me, maybe as a parent, that really stood out, because to think if your child has a limiting condition, they're nonverbal, they have physical disabilities, there's an element of loneliness perhaps that comes along with that, or a feeling of loneliness for the parent and the child. But this idea that they aren't alone, that they can go to this place and literally psychically connect with friends who are across cities, countries, that must be really, really a really nice feeling for the parents. Is that mm-hmm. something that's explored further in season two?
Yeah, the Hill.
Yep.
Yeah. So, okay. So just for people, so they know, like season two, I'd say half the episodes have non-speakers and half don't. And because we're really trying to explore consciousness and what it means and what these things are that we unpack. Right. And so the first episode of season one does not have a non-speaker in it, but it leads into the second episode that does. And one of the stories in that episode is about a young girl who had been talking about many friends that her mom couldn't find. And they were friends from the Hill, but it's really hard for these parents to even believe this stuff. You know, I think the telepathy tapes came out and we were getting a lot of emails from parents being like, could this be possible? Or I tested my kid and it actually turns out to be true. And my child was talking about this, but it's just so hard to believe. And, you know, so the parents are kind of in the same boat as most of us. And one of the things that was wonderful, this girl in episode two of season two, she had been saying a bunch of names. And because of what happened with the telepathy tapes, more and more parents were coming out about their experience joining telepathy, you know, autism Facebook groups, whatever. And they started finding each other. And so parents were starting to be like, oh, my daughter who's talking about a boy named Micah from this town in Wisconsin, all of a sudden this woman with a son named Micah or whatever, you know, from this town in Wisconsin was on the Facebook group. And the mom was like, can you ask your, you know, child if they have any friends from the Hill? And then that person said, yes, this person's name. And suddenly, boom, it was like, could this possibly, you know, and then it was. And they would FaceTime and the kids knew each other and would be spelling different things that was like in conversation in concert with the other, that when the second the parents would present what the child just spelled out, it would be in like complete communication with the other. And so it was remarkable because so many non-speakers started finding each other in real life due to their parents trying to validate this. And I think it was jaw-dropping for some of these parents to realize that the Hill was real, because that is sometimes most parents are like, yes, the telepathy is happening with me. It's happening into my house. I know that's happening. But like the idea of them jamming out telepathically in a chat room called the Hill is a different different thing to wrap your head around.
I like that jamming out good phrase. And I mentioned before, so this time we have a documentary being made in the background, and I suppose, is it a natural progression from the first season, which is audio-based, with the bonus content online with the videos and whatnot as well, that it would move to a documentary format? Because I'm a huge audio fan. People listening to this or watching this on YouTube, I always say audio is my favorite form of listening to anything. Podcasts are my go-to on a daily basis more than visual. But there's an element of this that really does work with that visual element. And how is that going to be different in season two and obviously with the documentary as well?
Yeah. Okay. So the documentary, I mean, that's our visual. That's everything right now. Right. So like we did start a Supercast channel. So we're trying to move all like videos over there. So Supercast is, you know, it's kind of like a Patreon, right? You can have like ad-free episodes, and there's all these questions that are being answered. Most of the parents are on our Supercast page for free. There's like an Ask Me Anything board where I feel like my staff is constantly chasing me down, like, answer this question, answer it, which is great. And so there's a lot of information and a lot of videos and behind the scenes videos, and also like kind of fun, just telepathy tape videos that we did on set. So that's kind of what we're populating now. And we're going to get up in the next week some of the videos from that aren't going to be in the film, because it wasn't like the science ones. It was just like our team being like, okay, let's blindfold and put a divider down. And, you know, or parents often would say, that is so rude what people are saying online. You know, my kid could do it behind a divider with earplugs in and with a blindfold on. Like, can we show? And, oh, yeah, let's do it. You know, so I think for a lot of the parents and the non-speakers, they were a little miffed, like, oh, okay, like, we can do that, no problem. So we are going to start putting up those videos on our Supercast page. Within the next week or two, there should be like a whole influx of new videos. But the most important tests will be in the film. I mean, those are the ones from different rooms, from different states. And there's a big, wild turn in the film where I don't know if it's ever happened. To my knowledge, it's never happened that like spontaneous, urgent, necessary telepathy has been captured to such an degree of accuracy accidentally in a kind of a quote unquote lab setting. And we were lucky enough to, I say lucky enough, but maybe the non-speakers orchestrated it that way, to capture it, on film. So yeah, I mean, the film is going to be the big visual, moment. And as far as like our episodes go, I mean, each of our episodes for season two, the reason it takes a year to pull together is it feels like making a documentary in many ways, right? Like we're trying to get access to people that have like deep information knowledge, like build their trust, like get their interviews, interweave it with like experts and other people who can corroborate. And so each of those takes a lot of time. And the reason we're doing it as a podcast, not a film, is because it's way more affordable to do it that way, right? Like I've made a lot of documentaries and it takes a ton of money to go travel and to get the cameras there and get the lighting right and get the audio right and get the footage downloaded and edited. So our seasons really are audio centric. And that's important because it allows us to do it affordably, which is so wonderful. But our Talk Treks episodes moving into season two are going to be mostly visual. And we're going to start having some like more specials, if you will. And then we have a lot of footage from filming that wasn't in, you know, that we couldn't get into the film. I think we've got, I mean, hundreds of hours of footage, and the film is going to be 2 hours long. So we're going to start putting clips of all that stuff on our Supercast page as well.
Have you got a time scale for the film, when you expect it to be ready or coming out?
For sure. I mean, we have a rough cut. We're going to show a focus group here in about a week. So that's really exciting. Then we're probably do like two or three more rounds of revisions. And then we plan to picture lock it in January. And picture lock is when no more changes can be made to the film. And you start doing the audio mix and putting in the score and doing the color correction and putting in the graphics, all the things that are really expensive that you can't go back and change. So picture locking in January, and then we hope to premiere it in sometime between like March and May of next year would be our goal. So TBD, if it's, you know, I don't know if it's going to play at a festival first or there's kind of a choose your own adventure. We have to see where it's going to end up. But the thing I'm grateful for is, you know, through a lot of, you know, donors and funders and stuff, we've been able to make this thing completely independent, which means that no one could, you know, tell us what, no one could censor it or tell us what we had to put in or what we couldn't put in and that type of thing. Mm. So it's the purest message, I think, from these families possible. So that's great.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And I think when you talk about how long it must take, folks have to understand it's not like you're pulling together your average interview. You know, when you're sitting in a room, you're not like, oh, Kai, can I have an hour of your time? Yeah, no problem. Let's just back and forward ask some questions. You've got children with often they're autistic, and mm-hmm. it's not easy for them to be in a room with a stranger, let alone mm-hmm. camera equipment being around there. Then you've got to try and get them to potentially partake in some form of scientific experiment. And mm-hmm. then to say to a parent, oh, can I check and see if your child is psychic? Do you mind? That must take a lot of time, relationship building, trust building, yeah. a lot of frustration. I can only imagine how often you start a session and it has to stop just for the benefit yeah. and the health of yeah. the child or the young adult who's yeah. part of it.
Well, that, yes, absolutely. And like for the film too, I think it ended up being like three times more expensive than most films I've ever made. And part of it is because it was like, anytime you travel and on speaker, there's often supports. There's often like special aids to come with. There's often like all those people have to travel and then stop in a city because they can only spend an hour on an airplane at a time and then travel again, you know? So it's like everything just ballooned. But that is why I think the end product will be special, is just like the time and effort to meet people where they were at so we could get the story told. And I mean, I think you're right. Like trust is a huge part of it. It's vulnerable and it's scary, and making sure these families kind of knew that we were prioritizing truth, not gimmicky tricks to get a lot of clicks, or, you know, that this wasn't like some huge, yeah, we're gonna make a ton of money off you. And none of it was like that, you know. It's just all like, this is a labor of love. And so I think that's, you know, I think we all feel really safe in each other's company right now, but that takes time. But it will be worth it. And the other thing that was really interesting to watch is the scientists, because so many scientists were, well, I want to do this. And I kept saying to so many of them, yes, please study this, but it's up to you to earn the trust. It's not up to me to earn your trust. And I, you know, because I told the scientists, I was like, we can't fund the research. That is so like not ethical, in my opinion. Like, if there's going to be unbiased research out there, we can film it, and that's what we're hoping to do, but we can't fund you to do the research. That's like the, you know, the Heart Association funding red meat research or something. So scientists had to get their own money, and we had to wait until some found funding. And the other thing that was interesting is once they found funding, I think they realized really quickly they had to not just make inroads and create relationships that were trusting, not with just non-speakers, but with their parents or with their teachers or with the school or with whatever, wherever they're going to do these tests. And that it could take months of figuring out how things work, what makes them tick, you know, to do the trial. And then only then can you do the experiment. And then each speller is different. Like one of the spellers that we show in the film who's doing a telepathy test, the way he does it is like, it's really interesting, is that, so the person sitting next to him has no idea what the cue is. And then when it starts to come to him and he feels like he has it, he first wants to type it out really quick on a letterboard. And it's like he needs that as like part of the step because that's what he learned. But then he can type right into a computer. So he'll go keyboard and then so he does like, it's like a two-step spelling thing for him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to learn each person's needs.
Let's go through some listener questions. I had loads of them sent in, Kai, so we'll try and get through what we can. And there's a whole different range of things to get through. Newman sent me a question for the first time in a while. So thank you, Newman. He actually sent this question for your interview in January, and we didn't get to it. So he's forwarded it back on this time round. So cheers for that. He says, I've been wondering whether during her research, Kai had the chance to also look into historical examples of known persons and whether they expressed frequent developmental peculiarities such as speech delayment that could hint towards them having had acquired some degree of ESP. And he gave the example of someone like Albert Einstein being one such person who had speech delayment.
That is really fascinating. No, I have not looked into that in a historical way, and that's a really wonderful thing that we should look into. So I will promise Newman that we will do a deep dive and do a Talk Tracks episode on that. But with that said, you know, Rupert Sheldrake, who, you know, many people I'm sure know because he's been a kind of a brave warrior in the space of the unexplained scientifically as a biologist from Cambridge for a long time. The way he got into this world was, I think it was in the 50s or 60s when Rupert, well, I don't know what time Rupert heard about this, but let me just back up. It was either in the 50s or 60s where Sir Rudolf Peters, who was a very well-renowned, obviously knighted scientist from Cambridge, discovered a boy who was blind and had what was considered severe, you know, learning and mental disabilities, was able to read an eye chart, but only if his mom was looking at it. And the, you know, the ophthalmologist was shocked. Rupert, I mean, he brought the mom out of the room and the boy couldn't do it. Brought the mom back into the room, the boy could do it. So this ophthalmologist told Sir Rudolf Peters about this. Sir Rudolf Peter did his own experiments, putting this mom and the son in rooms across, you know, town. And they did these telepathy experiments over the phone. And the odds were well beyond chance. And it was so remarkable that when Rupert Sheldrake heard about this, he thought it was completely rubbish. But as any good scientist should do, he didn't just discount it. He kind of looked into the experiments. He looked over what Sir Rudolf Peters had told him. He knew Sir Rudolf Peters was obviously a renowned scientist, a very respectable man. He was knighted after all. And that made Rupert Sheldrake go into the field. And there's another man named Bernie Rimland. And this was maybe 30 years ago. He had a son on the spectrum who was showing signs of telepathy. and he was like the first scientist out there. He was also a scientist who said, look, I think ESP should be considered a savant skill like the other savant skills. So this stuff has been dotted throughout history and known. But what'd be really interesting is to go through, do a deep, 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 deep dive. And so thank you for that question.
Can I follow up on that one from mm-hmm. Neil? Neil says, has Kai ever come across or heard about non-autistic people who have lost the ability to communicate or maybe experienced hypostasia and gained psi ability? Basically, does she think it's possible that a brain doesn't have full control over bodily senses could be a loose anchor to our consciousness?
Yes, and I highly encourage anyone interested in that question to go listen to the talk tracks because we did a few interesting episodes, and I want to tell you about some highlights from those episodes. So the talk track season one for the telepathy tapes are deep dives into some of these concepts, and one of the stories in there was about a man whose wife had, well, actually, I have to tell you this part of the story. We started getting tons of emails after the telepathy tapes came out of people who said, my spouse, my father, whoever, I'm a caregiver, I'm a nurse dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. And this is common in this community. However, it's just like these parents. We don't talk about it. We don't share it because people are going to think we're crazy. And one of the emails we got was from a man whose wife had recently died of early onset Alzheimer's dementia. And she came to him one time when he was exhausted. And he was like, I wish I knew how I could help you go to the bathroom quicker because it took her 30 minutes. And she's like, okay, just ask me. But he's like, what? I know she can't talk. What is this? And it was in his mind. And then she went through with like showing him images in his mind, like telepathically, of how to help her go to the bathroom quicker. He tried it the next day, minutes, and it worked. The next day when he was falling asleep, he thought maybe this can happen again. Asked her, okay, how do I get you in the car? How do I get you into the car in less than 30 minutes? Because it's taking forever to go anywhere, the grocery store, to the doctor, same thing. And so one of our, I think it's going to be episode 9 or 10 of season 2, we're doing a huge deep dive into this dementia thing with telepathy. Another thing you should listen to in the talk tracks is an episode about a woman who was in a coma and down the street in her old house, these kids kept saying they saw this little girl in the house, and they hired like a kind of like paranormal investigator, all this stuff. He found a picture in the attic of this little girl. They figured out, well, okay, who this little girl might be. And is this a ghost that's haunting it? They found the brother of this girl from, you know, who's now an old man, went to his house. And it turned out he's like, that's my sister, but she's not dead. She's in a coma. She's like extremely sick. She's dying, but she's up in the room. And they went up and talked to this woman, and she was like, I'm going to that house all the time in my dreams. I know these kids. Like, they, you have to hear the whole story on the talk tracks. But in short, it seems like some of these abilities, telepathy, The ability to like astral project can turn on most deeply when you are in, when you lose the faculties of your regular brain. And what does that mean about consciousness? So yes, it's something we explore, and we explore a lot in season two, and we explore a lot in the talk tracks.
Here's a question from Ian, a little bit longer, so hang on with this one with me, Kai. Kai has repeatedly mentioned that the non-speakers seem to believe their gifts are only accessible to those with good intentions and a loving heart. If true, this would make greed, anger, envy, and the worst aspects of the human psyche an unbreachable barrier to reaching these abilities. I wish I could believe that. Yet having experienced firsthand as a targeted individual, the power of the occult arts, including spirit possession, mind control, full body apparition of shadow figures and physical interaction and telekinesis, I don't believe this view is accurate. I am, however, certain that the beings of light and compassion always prevail against the darkness when called upon. What are your thoughts on this, or the thoughts of the young non-speakers?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things, right? That like, we know there's darkness in the world. We know there's dark energy in the world. We know there's evil in the world. And I do think that there are people who can have these gifts, just like we all have these gifts. They're part of human nature, that don't have good intentions. I don't think there's a single non-speaker out there who would ever say that they would use their gifts for ill intentions. And I think that's really important, because it's not like so many of these parents are struggling and that type of thing. You know, financially it takes a lot, right, to raise someone. It's I think that the distinction for the non-speakers is they're not using their gifts to win the lottery and bet on a horse race and, you know, manipulate the world into the favor of themselves or their family. So I think that's really important. And I do think I have seen now, because we explored a lot in season two, that like, coming into something from a position of love and safety and belief helps these gifts amplify and turn on. But I think that's true of a lot of things. If you believe you're going to do a great job and you have a really good attitude when you're going to go play your basketball game or do your piano recital, you're probably going to do better. So I think a lot of this isn't just about ESP, it's just human nature. If you have a good attitude, you believe in yourself, you believe in the power of what you're capable of, you enjoy what you're doing, you have a good intention and a good mindset around it, it's going to amplify whatever you're doing. I think that's kind of like a basic human thing. So I don't doubt that there's like negative people who can use gifts for harmful things. I just don't think that's as powerful as the other end of it, the force of love.
And I think, to be fair, and probably a different conversation for a different day, a huge aspect of why these types of gifts and abilities are likely suppressed is the fact that they would be weaponized by modern day. We know there are all kinds of programs from the US government and other governments, not just to pick on the US, of course, that have explored using things like ESP, remote viewing, for military tactics, for viewing nuclear assets, for finding targets. And that's just what would happen. We hear about it all the time with the UFO topic. You hear about it with like the psychic spies phenomenon. So that makes sense, that it's not just folks who are pure of heart and all that kind of stuff. But I understand your point of view, the idea that there's just a positivity, enhances it, amplifies it, makes it perhaps easier to use.
And even with the psychic spy program, like many people, if you're interested in that, you should read Annie Jacobson's book, Phenomenon, which is all about the psychic spy program in the United States based on CIA's like declassified, you know, material around it. But they were burnt out being told to do these negative, you know, go look for, you know, hostages or find this or look for this. Like if something is like negative and repetitive and boring, and there's no like real sense of purpose and good, like it burns you out. You might do it really well a few times, and then you kind of putz her out. And that's happened to a lot of those spies in the, you know, Project Grill Flame and those things that the US was engaged in. So I mean, we're human. We have both sides to us. But I think from what the non-speakers have said, and that's all I can go off of because they're the most reputable sources I have around this stuff, is that for them, the telepathy, the gifts turn on much more readily when there's love and acceptance and belief involved.
We'll try and fly through another couple of these questions because I've got so many of them. Mark asked if you had any of your own experiences with telepathic abilities or consciousness.
I think in episode 3 of season 2, we have a major episode on what consciousness is doing with us while we're alive. You know, we kind of look at what it's doing with us from beyond the grave and all sorts of stuff. And I do believe that the world is conscious and that ideas even have their own consciousness and will, and they are looking for people to help make them manifest. And episode 3 really explores what they're looking for in a human collaborator. And I have experienced that where something is not my idea, is not my whatever, but there's that beautiful balance between effort and surrender when you truly surrender and kind of let yourself be manhandled by this gift or whatever it is, but by ideas or by inspiration, it will show you what it wants to make manifest. So I think that like listening and being tuned with an antenna to that stuff has always been really real for me. If this is confusing, again, episode 3 is going to really dive into that. And I think there's some stuff that's happened in dreams that I thought was just a dream. And now I'm starting to realize, oh, that was someone, I think, trying to communicate with me. So, but right now my whole focus is primarily on storytelling. And I can't, once that chapter is waning, which I hope isn't for a long time, I hope to then like really dive into more of this stuff experientially on my own. But right now it's really trying to bring to light others who are experiencing it.
I remember I've said a few times on the podcast, I lucid dream quite a lot. I know when I'm dreaming, you know, it's just a weird thing, but it's what it is. If people want to know more about it or ask me questions, they can get in touch. But I remember as a kid dreaming that I was playing football with my friend who lived just across the road from me, literally at a little bit of grass next to where I lived. And I remember meeting him in the dream and saying, oh, like tomorrow, like, are you awake? And he was like, yeah. And we had a little conversation. And I said, I always remember saying to him, I'm going to say spaghetti to you, okay? And that's going to prove that, you know, and I know that we've spoken this dream. And I always remember the next day, and his name is Gianluca. I remember saying to him like, oh, spaghetti. And he was like, huh? And I was like, the dream last night, you know? And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, never mind. Just like totally gone past it. Maybe not for everyone, but it's a weird thing, the whole lucid dreaming thing and sleep and whatever it is. On that, Paul asks, have any of the kids met with mediums or remote viewers or experiencers?
Well, yeah, episode 2. I don't want to, just that question will be answered in episode 2 of season 2. We would do a deep dive into mediums and I think there's a lot of really evidential like science stuff that comes out in that episode as well.
I'll skip to the final question for you, Kai. JH had asked, has Kai asked the children about what they think of the nature of reality, or is that a conversation that comes up?
Yeah, it comes up all the time. And we put a bunch of writings on our Supercast channel because, you know, again, like it's like there's a protective element too. You don't want to just have this stuff on the internet, right? But like there is a lot on our Supercast channel about the nature of reality. And of course, what I think is true about all of us, and non-speakers are no different, they're individuals, is there is a filter in which you're raised, right? In which how you see the world. Most will say that consciousness is fundamental, that, you know, the metaphysical world is almost more real than our physical world, that our thoughts are incredibly powerful and we create a lot of what is happening with our thoughts. And not only do our thoughts have a reach far beyond our bodies, but so do our feelings. And all those are influencing the world around us. So I fully believe the world is conscious and the thoughts are the basis of it. And again, we're going to really dive deep into this in episode four of season 2, where we look in savants, and one of the savants thinks he's like invented a whole like, I don't even know what to call it, like physics or biology, like a whole new subject, really, or math. Like, he has a whole, form of looking at the world that like science hasn't really even like understands him yet. And AI is the first thing to really understand what he's talking about. And he says the world, I mean, kind of like in this very holographic, I guess, way, right? He says that the world, what physics and math are looking at and explaining is, if you will, like a screen. They're looking at the screen, but he can see behind it. He can see the inner workings, and he explains it, how it all works. It's a really heavy, deep episode. And so he's like, we're getting it all wrong. Like, we're looking at the screen, and that's what everyone's studying is the screen, but there's so much more happening behind the screen. And with his whole like holographic universe kind of theory, you know, there's millions of probabilities of what can happen at any time, right? And like, it's like the one thing that's happening at that time of all the sum of all the probabilities is like what we're experiencing right now on the earth. And so he explains it better than I do. So yeah, that will be around early November, episode 4 of season 2.
Well, Kai, let me give you the final word then. How can people find and watch and listen to the new season of The Telepathy Tapes?
Yeah. So season 2 of The Telepathy Tapes drops October 15th. It will be anywhere you can find your podcasts, Spotify, you know, Apple, iHeartRadio, YouTube. And if you want ad-free episodes and really want to dive deeper and read more of what the non-speakers are saying and watch more videos and ask me anything and go on the Discord page, that's where I encourage people to join our Supercast page.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the